This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
Every U.S. president and most candidates tout the importance of small business to the economy, but our next guests say their significance to the success of America's economy has been greatly exaggerated. They say that it's big business that is really responsible for most of America's job creation and innovation, while having to deal with a greater impact from regulation than smaller counterparts. Rob Atkinson is founder and president of Washington, D.C. think tank Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Mike Lind is visiting professor at the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. They're co-authors of the new book, Big is Beautiful, Debunking the Myth of Small Business, and it's a pleasure to have them joining us both right now. Rob, Mike, great to have you both with us. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. So, Rob, then, if big is beautiful, how do you guys view small business?
We have a pretty clear view that what we have to do is what Mike and I call size neutrality. Right now, we're in a world of idolatry of small business. They're great. They could do nothing wrong. They're responsible for all the good jobs and innovation, when in fact that's just not true. So the best thing we could do is just stop, you know, idolizing small business and demonizing big business and just say the market's going to produce the kinds of firms we need, and we shouldn't worry about size.
Mike?
Yeah, I think one of the problems with this discussion is people confuse support for large business with support for abuses.
Right.
We're not arguing that firms should be able to abuse their employees or pollute or raise prices in anti-competitive ways and so on. But as Rob says, we favor size neutrality. A small firm of six people whose employer abuses the employees needs to suffer the same punishment as a large firm. Most of the evils that are attributed to big business, including campaign finance, abuses of employees, things like that, are characteristic of bad businesses of every size, and they should be regulated on a size-neutral basis.
And that part of it you mentioned, or Rob mentioned, Mike, about the issues surrounding politics and regulation, the impact that certain companies do see, and it's part of what we've seen play out on Capitol Hill over the last several decades for quite a long period of time, is that these companies are trying to have some sort of influence, I guess to a degree, to try and keep the scales balanced to a degree.
Well, one of the points we make in the book is, if anything, the scales are unbalanced, and they're unbalanced in the direction of small companies.
Right.
If you're a small company, you can legally discriminate on the basis of race and gender, religion. You pay significantly lower taxes because you're small. There are wide exemptions on that. There are a whole set of regulatory exemptions. They have their own agency, the Small Business Administration. They get subsidized loans. So you put all that together, frankly, the regulatory tax and expenditure feel. Oh, and they have their own procurement benefits. So the government just doesn't buy things that are best for the taxpayer. They preference small business, even though it costs more money. So this notion somehow that big companies are getting their way and running roughshod in Congress is actually not true. Many of the most powerful and effective business lobbies in Washington are actually small business lobbies. National Association of Realtors, for example, the car dealers, the beverage wholesalers, the National Federation of Independent Businesses. These are powerful lobbies, and they lobby to protect their small companies, which is their job, but it's not the job of Congress to fall for it.
So, Mike, then in this realm that we're in right now, big business benefits from where right now?
Benefits? Well, one of the reasons you do see a long-term growth in concentration and size of business is simply technology in fields like aerospace and telecommunications and automobile manufacturing and so on. Big firms are just more efficient in basic engineering terms because of increasing returns to scale than small firms. And this is often a benefit to the employees. As Rob and I document in Big is Beautiful, on most measures, whether if not all measures, whether it's wages, civil rights protections, benefits, you're better off working for a big regional or national or global company than for some small mom-and-pop store.
You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton here on Sirius XM 132, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, talking with the authors of the book, Big is Beautiful, Debunking the Myth of Small Business, Robert Atkinson, Michael Lind. Your comments again at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment via Twitter, either at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. I mean, Rob, I think it's a basic tenet when you look at what the potential growth and build out of big businesses and the production ability of big business compared to small businesses, the multiplier may be tenfold, 20-fold what a big company can do compared to a small business.
Yeah, you know, it's something that we tend to ignore because we think, oh, small business is creating all these jobs and all. But actually, a lot of studies have shown this, not just in the U.S., but around the world. For example, in the U.S., the four largest firms in any particular industry have, on average, 37% higher productivity than the rest of the firms in the industry. They pay 15% higher wages. Overall, large companies are much more productive. And also, interestingly, new research in the last 5 years has shown, just to your point exactly, large companies are actually as innovative, if not more, relative to the amount of their sales, because they can spread that innovation or that R&D so much more broadly. So if you're doing R&D in a particular area in a big firm, it might benefit three or four different product lines and drive innovation that way. So a lot of our thinking about big and small businesses is just really out of date.
Then the negative impact that Mike, that big business feels because of the narrative that is out there, impacts it how much? How much in terms of productivity do you think that mindset potentially impacts big business?
Well, I think it depends on the policies that it leads to.
Okay.
If you have a purely national antitrust policy and you're breaking up your most dynamic and competitive firms with the greatest investment in R&D and the greatest productivity, as Rob says, and your competitors in Europe and East Asia are boosting national champions, in some cases subsidizing them with the government, then you're not only crippling these big firms, but you're undermining American productivity and competitiveness.
Rob?
Yeah, I would add to that, actually. You know, it's funny, Europe used to be a lot better on this, but in the last few years with Margaret Vestager, who's head of their competition bureau, she has become what we have a term in the book, what we call neo-Brandeisian thinking. And what that really refers to is famous Justice Louis Brandeis, who really made his career on opposing the rise of industrialization in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and then the rise of big firms that, you know, Chandler and others touted as the, you know, engine of American success. Vestager and her bureau, just in the last week or two, they denied a merger from two companies, Alstom and Siemens, to combine and build a more competitive high-speed rail industry and company. And the reason these two companies needed to do that is because the Chinese high-speed rail company was forced to merge into a national champion. They are massively subsidized, and they've now taken over, I believe, 50% of the new builds, 60% of the new high-speed rail builds. And so here are these companies that are fighting for their life and saying, if we don't get scale, we're going to get crushed by the Chinese massive competitor. And yet, this neo-Brandeisian small is beautiful thinking now prevails in Europe, and they've denied the merger. And we see the same thing here. In fact, today in Congress, there's a Senate hearing. Have big businesses gotten too big?
Yeah.
The answer is no, they have not gotten too big. If anything, they need to get bigger.
How do you move that forward, though, when you have a lot of the policies and a lot of the mindset about trying to protect the small business or prevent that growth that you talk about in the book that you would like to see?
Well, part of it is education, as we try to promote in Big is Beautiful, Debunking the Myth of Small Business. Part of it is focusing on the interests of workers as workers. There tends to be this assumption that small business owners are somehow the typical Americans. That's not true. Fewer than 10% of Americans are owners and operators of their own small businesses. And the typical American today works for a very large firm. 51.5% of all employment in the U.S. Is with firms with more than 500 employers. That shocks a lot of people. Firms that have only 0 to 4 employees account for only 5.2% of all employment. So the odds are, if you're an American worker, you're working for a medium to big firm, and it's just your interest as wage earners is not identical with the interests of mostly very well-to-do people who own their own small businesses.
So I would think then, Rob, that leads me to believe that where we are right now, the potential of seeing increased activity when you have a small business, the potential of it being swallowed up and merging with a larger company is going to increase as we move along because of the fact that there is a want by a lot of people to try and start small businesses, that percentage of failure success rate being played in there as well.
Well, you know, it's funny. In the book, we highlight a lot of research on this. And the vast majority of small business startups in the U.S. are lifestyle businesses. And we don't mean that in a pejorative sense. They're people who do not want to get big. The last thing in the world they want to do is run a 300 or 400 or 500 person company and all the hassles and heartache that comes with that.
Right.
They just want to have a nice life, maybe employ their wife and their kid and a couple of other people and do that. More power to them. That's great. But those are not the kind of companies that are going to grow the American economy or make us more innovative or more competitive. There are a smaller segment of companies that are high growth companies. They're startups. They want to spin out of Penn or another university or whatever they might be. And what's interesting about that, there's this, again, a lot of mythology out there. One of the myths out there is that we've seen this dearth of business startups. And the reality is we have. But what we have not seen, in fact, we have more of them now than we did 10 years ago, are high-growth startups. So the kinds of companies that want to turn into the next Google or the next Amazon or whatever, we're seeing more of those than we used to. So this notion somehow that big companies are squashing the little guys to come up with a new mousetrap, that's not really what the evidence shows.
One of the data points that I see, Mike, from time to time on a monthly basis, it involves productivity. And we have seen, in many cases, productivity that has probably not been, when you're talking about the U.S. economy in general, productivity that hasn't been as good as probably a lot of people would have hoped it would have been. With that data out there, how does that play into this discussion of big company versus small company?
Well, if you look at productivity growth across the economy, it's driven by a fairly small number of sectors, including advanced manufacturing. And it's dragged down by low-wage, labor-intensive sectors, let's say nursing homes or lawn mowing businesses, which are labor-intensive. They're very static technologically. The firms do not have the scale to engage in R&D or diffuse best practices. So arguably, one of the best things you can do in boosting U.S. productivity is to look at these laggard sectors where you have static technology and very labor-intensive methods of production of goods and services and modernize them, which would mean having bigger, more capital-intensive firms able to do technological improvements rather than having it fragmented among a lot of low-wage, labor-intensive small businesses.
844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter, at BizRadio132, or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. We go to the phones right now in Los Angeles. Robin is on the line. Robin, welcome.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I worked for two small businesses during my career. It was the worst experience of my life.
Oh, wow, okay.
They don't know the law. I had one of the owners of the company actually walk up to me and say, "What are you?" Meaning, "What is my race?"
Oh, wow.
Okay, that's completely illegal.
Yeah.
I had another manager walk up to me and say, "Yeah, I heard you're not as young as everyone thinks."
Okay. All right.
And when I tried to shut him down, he kept going.
Yeah.
And there's no HR department to go to address it.
Okay. Robin, thanks for the comment. And I mean, Rob, that's one example, but I wonder if, you know, if there is more of this type of activity potential in a small business rather than a big business, just off of what she said, because of the ability or inability to have an HR department.
Well, absolutely. So two important points that the caller makes. Number one, the U.S. Congress has basically exempted these kind of companies from employment law. They legally can do what she just said they did. And that's outrageous. Why should a small company with 10 workers be able to discriminate on the ages, on the basis of gender or race or religion or national origin? And yet they can. And the reason Congress does that is, well, we don't want to burden small companies. And since when did gender discrimination, not discriminating on the basis of gender or race, become a burden? So that's kind of how far this nonsense has gotten. But second key point there is, and you make it, is big companies are under scrutiny all the time. If they make a mistake and one of their employees reports on it, they can suffer serious reputational damage. They can suffer harm if they're a consumer products company. It's the small companies that can get away with this. The caller had a problem, but what's she going to do? There's no HR department. She can't sort of shame the firm into behaving properly. So that's a big problem. A lot of small firms, there are a lot of great small firms that don't do this kind of thing. But if you are in that category, whether you're polluting illegally or you're discriminating against your workers, it's hard to get caught.
Mike, anything to add there?
Well, just on the second point, you know, there will be exposés in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Financial Times of some big multinational that's accused of mistreating its workers, accurately or not. The same practice going on with small firms probably can't get exposed even in the local newspaper.
Robin, thanks very much for the call. Greatly appreciate it. 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. So, I mean, Rob, part of this, obviously, going back to something we mentioned at the start of this interview, is that there are instances where both big companies and small companies go afoul of the law or of regulation. And in many cases, it is the big company that ends up getting the publicity. How do we try and also impact having those big companies and small companies to again as well, try and see if we can avoid the negative to begin with, the negative activity in the first place?
Well, again, when you look at the evidence, and this is all data from the federal government, on average, again, there are some bad or scofflaw big companies and great small companies, but on average, small firms pollute more per dollar of sales. They injure their workers more per worker. They violate other kinds of laws more. It's interesting. We hear all this talk about, oh, big companies hire all these lawyers, these accountants and lawyers. They don't pay taxes. Actually, tax avoidance by small companies is about 2 to 3 times larger than tax avoidance by big companies. So, again, it goes back to the fact that big companies have a lot of incentive to obey the law. It's not to say they always do. They have departments that make sure that. And then most importantly, if you look at the odds of being audited, the odds of being inspected by OSHA, the odds of being inspected by EPA, they're significantly higher if you're a big company than a small company. Small companies just get a pass on a lot of this. They don't ever see the government sort of making sure and checking up on them. So not surprisingly, they don't comply with the law as much on average.
Mike, your thoughts?
Well, one of the things we hear about is that big business is much more likely to corrupt politicians than small firms. But as Rob and I point out in the book, some of the most powerful lobbies in Washington are trade associations of small businesses, or, for example, the American Medical Association for, you know, independent practitioners in many cases. Automobile dealers, opticians have incredibly powerful lobbies, and they've managed to use their clout to hurt competitors and to prevent technological progress that would undermine their business models. And we don't hear about them. We hear about billionaires and big firms using money in politics.
Rob, one of the chapters you talk about or you have in the book talks about antitrust. And I wanted you to spend a couple of moments, if you could, talking about the impact that antitrust has had in this process as well.
Sure. So, you know, antitrust or, you know, aggressive antitrust, if you will, is seeing somewhat of a revival today with, again, based on large amounts of mythology. For example, Robert Reich, the famous gadfly and professor, is testifying in the Senate today. And yet, Reich wrote a big article about antitrust where he says that the U.S. pays the highest prices for airlines, broadband, food, and banking because of monopoly. It turns out that we pay some of the lowest prices for banking, food, and airlines, and broadband is kind of in the middle. So part of the problem is a lot of the folks in this debate, it's just a completely fact-free zone. They make these assertions. But going down that path would be a big problem because we went down that path in the past, particularly in the 50s and 60s, where the U.S. government actually forced leading American technology companies to give away for free their intellectual property and their patents. So case in point was RCA. Listeners are old enough to remember RCA, Radio Corporation of America. Yeah. They were the most innovative, probably the most innovative technology company in the 50s. They really pioneered color TV, incredible innovations. And they were broken up, if you will, by the federal government saying they were a monopoly. Turns out that their monopoly led to a price increases of TVs by about 1%. What happened with that? Well, what happened with that is they were forced, because they had to give away their technology domestically, they licensed their technology to the Japanese. That's the single biggest reason why the Japanese destroyed our television industry. They got the technology from RCA. RCA yeah. never would have done that if the Justice Department hadn't forced them to do that. And we've seen that over and over again with IBM, with Kodak. Many, many companies have had to do this. Xerox, another good example, where we lost market share to the Japanese, like Ricoh and Canon. That was all because the federal government forced Xerox to give away their technology. And we're going into the same kind of direction now, which to me and Mike is quite troubling.
844 Wharton is the number to give us a call, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter, at BizRadio132, or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. You know, Mike, towards the end of the book, you guys ask an interesting question at the end. And I think I'd love to get the response on this, because I think the response from a lot of consumers would be no. But you ask the question, can we ever really like big business?
Well, there's, as we point out in Big is Beautiful, there's this very old Jeffersonian tradition in the United States, very powerful, saying that the good citizen is an independent, self-reliant farmer or small craftsman or small business owner, and that modern large-scale industry and corporations somehow were the snake in the Garden of Eden that destroyed this wonderful Jeffersonian paradise. And we have to go back to it. So we're kind of fighting more than two centuries of nostalgia for this agrarian economy of small producers. But that world vanished a century ago, right? It's 100 years out of date in most of the country. Most Americans have been wage earners working for firms of increasing size for 100 years. So a lot of this is nostalgia, but politically it's very powerful.
Rob, final comment. Got about 45 seconds.
Restoring at least some level of trust in big business as a progressive force for America's future is super important. And we don't want to suggest that big business doesn't have a role to play there. One of the things they need to do is they need to publicly decry scoff laws, for example, like Wells Fargo when they did what they did recently. They need to step up and say more aggressively, this is not an acceptable kind of business behavior.
Right.
And they need to do more, frankly, to reduce financialization of the economy, to say we're going to try to work and invest for the long term and for the good of America. So it's not as if big businesses haven't played a role in this, but demonizing big companies will come at a cost to all of us and to America's future.
Great having you both with us. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Mike. All the best with the book.
Thank you.
Rob Atkinson, Mike Lind, co-authors of the book Big is Beautiful, Debunking the Myth of Small Business.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.